Okay, let's get right to hour number two. George Filer and Frank Chile are with me, and that was quite a first hour. We will next Wednesday have Judy and George and Frank back, and we'll go through her story in great detail. Her book is called The Hydrogen Cipher. I'm going to link that to her name in guests shortly, and it has, as she said, the whole story in there. There is so much out there that's been taken away, hidden from us. You know what's going on. It's quite remarkable. Otis Carr, if you want to look into it in any more detail, Otis Carr built what he called a flying saucer, a spaceship. And I can't tell you if it worked or not. I don't know. But there's a 9-part series on it on the internet, on YouTube. You can find it. And I'll stick one of them up there, and you can track down the others if you like. But very interesting. Okay, we are back, and we're going to meet this hour a very special gentleman who I've had on the program before. And George Filer, why don't you go ahead and introduce Jan Harzan for us.
Well, Jan recently retired from IBM after 37 years in the information technology business. He attended the UCLA School of Engineering and mm-hmm. received his BS in nuclear engineering. And he might be interested in what Judy has to say.
I would think so, yeah.
In any case, after college, he was hired by IBM and worked there, as I mentioned, for 37 years. And as a boy, he became very interested in UFOs and started trying to build one with his brother. And lo and behold, he had a sighting when he's like 10 years old of a UFO up close. Now, he's followed this field for pretty much his entire life, and he was just in August of last year named the executive director of MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network. And so we're happy to hear what Jan has to say.
Hello, Jan. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Jeff. Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Boy, you sound younger than ever. I'll bet it's been 15 years since you were on, something like that, 10 anyway.
It's been a while.
So things are going well for you. You're happy. You sound like you're doing something you really enjoy. The Mutual UFO Network has seemed to me to have lacked some kind of driving energy of true wisdom at the top, and it's got it now. So congratulations, and they're very lucky to have you.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I appreciate that. We've got a lot of great people in MUFON, you know, over 3,000 members, and a lot of good scientists. We just need direction and a clear mission and goals, and we're going to go make some things happen here. So that's my whole plan in being at the top right now.
Exactly. George, anything else you want to say?
Well, I think things are moving along quite nicely, and we're having a big conference that Jan will tell you more about in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, in July.
Why not so, Medford, New Jersey?
Well, there's no hotels in Medford.
Well, you could.
I'm not
put
from New
mic.
Jersey, so you've got me stumped.
Me too.
Yeah, the I'll just talk a little bit about our symposiums. You know, the way it's been done for a number of years is that we've always given it to one of our sections, our chapters. So in this case, it's being done by the Philadelphia chapter under John Ventry and his team, which is outstanding there.
He's terrific. Yeah, John's been on the program before, yeah.
But I found it interesting that they took it across the river to New Jersey to hold it. But I think the reason is because the hotel rates are so incredible there. And it's only 15 minutes from downtown Philadelphia. And the hotel has just been completely renovated. It's the Crown Plaza, so it should be very, very nice.
That'll be nice.
But what we need to do, and my intent is to, on all these symposiums, is to try to create more of a conference division within MUFON and try to put on just spectacular events, more than one per year, or team up with other people who do conferences and put them on there. I think just trying to get the word out, build awareness among the public about the subject as much as we can will only go further help us with our goals and strategies. So We're looking at a number of different things that we can do to grow membership, to increase public awareness, to get the word out through the media on some very significant cases we have. And I think by doing that, we're going to ratchet it up to a point where what I'd really like to see happen, Jeff, is the scientists, the researchers in this country be able to study this phenomenon without fear of reprisal. In other words, to be encouraged, to be funded, to not worry about losing career points, if you were.
Oh, we've got to get there, Jan.
Yes, we have absolutely got to get there. If we're ever going to get this thing in the white world to where it is in the black world right now.
That's right. I've always had the feeling. Now, Walt Andrus was the first president of the Mutual UFO Network. 37 years, was it? Something like that?
Well, 30 years, yeah. He ran MUFON from about 1969 until all the way to 2000. Yeah.
The organization, unfortunately, is staffed by wonderful people who do all the legwork and everything. But it has an image in the outer world, and you already know this, I'm sure, of information in and not very much coming out. And you've got all these marvelous cases. It's like they just disappear.
Well, you know, it's funny because when I first joined MUFON back in the late 80s, early 90s, I remember sitting around a kitchen table in the state director's house. We were doing a little section director's meeting and talking about that. We called it the black hole, right? And
that's
the
right.
problem was, of course, in those days, was that all the files went to Walt's home, and he put them in his garage, and they went into filing cabinets. But, you know, we didn't have computers. I mean, we had computers, but we didn't have, like, personal computers back in those days.
No.
Not like we do today. They certainly didn't have the Internet and the ability to change stuff. But all that information exists now, and so what we're trying to do is to and that's a whole other strategy, is the whole IT strategy, and how do you get this information out?
Mm-hmm.
And so we're working very diligently to come up with a plan to do that and make it as visible as possible. If you go on our website today, MUFON.com, you can actually see, as things come in, there's stories being written and published on the site. I'm trying to get a vivid photo file going and some other things. It's a struggle because, you know, it's different than what's been done in the past, but you just have to keep...
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Much different than the past, and I'm really glad to hear that. So,
yeah, and you know, it's I don't think there's any malice or any intent to hide anything. It's just people, you know, frankly, MUFON's been run by researchers for so long, the researchers tend to go into their den and read a book and sit there by themselves and just pour through it and then put the files away in their drawer and go to bed. And it's like, what good does that do? It doesn't get the information out to the people who need to know. And that's the everyday citizen who needs to understand that this phenomena is real.
That's exactly correct. Now, you are, without question, one of the most gifted researchers in this field that has ever been, in my opinion, and I'm not blowing smoke. I know the kind of work you do. And just to be sitting on top of a mountain of hard evidence and anecdotal material and all kinds of reports and sightings, it must be exhilarating and frustrating at the same time.
Well, it is, but, you know, frankly, that's one of the hopes we have with the Hangar One TV show, is to take these cases and take the best of the cases and start just replaying them for people.
No one's ever heard them before, of course.
Exactly. I mean, and we have so many. It's the producer of the show came to our offices, and we shared with him what we had, and he looked at it, and he said, oh, my gosh, he says, there's 12 years worth of programs here, seasons we could do. There's so much stuff. And we said, yeah, there is. Uh-huh. I mean, it's just incredible. Of course, you know, TV has its own pluses and minuses. I mean, it's not a documentary medium per se. So at best you're telling stories, but you've got good, credible witnesses. You've got great, incredible stories. And just people begin to realize that, you know, it can't all be false.
Of course not. No. It would take someone who is really anti-intellectual to make such a judgment. That's not even, it's not even fair intellectually to rule something out. We're looking at a Mount Everest of data here. And it's not all bogus. It's not all swamp gas. And, I mean, it's just absurd.
Well, the big complaint I get from people is, you know, why should, you know, we've been collecting sighting reports for 60 years now. Why do that? That doesn't sound like a very useful thing to do. Well, that may be the case, but what we've done with MUFON is we've got a very detailed collection system where we collect about 200 data points on every sighting. And our hope is that at some point that scientists, when they really do begin to look at this thing, will come and use that database to help figure out. In fact, I was talking to a scientist yesterday. I won't mention his name on the air because he didn't give me permission to, but who basically heard about one of our sightings. I was just reviewing some of the sightings we had with him, and he saw one. He said, "Oh, my gosh, that's the kind of sighting we need." He says, "Who can I talk to about it?" I said, "Well, you tell me what you want, and we'll talk to the witness, see if they're willing to, and then we'll have you go meet with them." And so what the case was, it was part of our annual report from 2012 where we talked about our top 10 sightings for the year. It was an aircraft down south. I believe it was in Alabama. I could be mistaken on the country because I don't have it in front of me right now. But it was a father and son pilot. Actually, it was in Virginia. I apologize, Virginia. Mm-hmm. Who were flying between two points. And as they came in for approach, a 30-foot ball of energy came up underneath their wing. And when it did so, and began tracking with them, and when it did so, the engine, the instruments cut out, the engine sputtered, and they began to kind of lose power on the plane. And right as that was happening, this thing just moved away and then shot off, like up into space, out of sight. And everything came back on. And of course, it was those physical effects that the scientist was most interested in. Like, how did it affect that craft? So we have the data. We have the cases. They're coming in more every day. And we just need to get the right people to look at them and kind of say, okay, now how would you duplicate this? What could you build that would cause these kind of effects? And hopefully, by doing so, we're going to totally transform transportation on this planet, maybe transportation within our own solar system or in our universe. I don't know how far this would extend. Hopefully, it'll increase energy systems and allow us to create non-polluting things. To me, there's just so many incredible technology breakthroughs that are possible by studying this that it's crazy that we're not.
Well, unless we do, and unless we somehow acquire that knowledge, the planet is finished. We have environmentally turned the corner, and it is clearly disintegrating.
Well, and I think that's right, and I think they're not going to let that happen, and I don't think we're going to let that happen. So it's imperative that we get on with it. Don't wait any longer.
Said it very nicely, indeed. Now let's go back to when you were a kid. You want to build a flying saucer. What got you involved with that? What inspired you as a child? What captured your vision and your imagination?
Well, when I grew up, it was in the 50s and 60s, and so I was born in 1954. So, you know, when I was 7, 8 years old, very early 60s, 61, 62, this subject was in the front pages of the paper almost, you know, every week.
That's before the lid came down. They used to report in 1950s and 60s, there would be UFO reports frequently in the papers, major, regional, local, it didn't matter.
And it was usually on the front page.
Yep.
So as a young kid, I would see that. You know, I wasn't like I was reading newspapers at the age of 8, but I would see the you know, UFOs seen over Washington, or UFOs seen here, or UFOs seen there. And so I became fascinated with it. And my father subscribed to two men's magazines of the day. One was called True.
Oh,
the
sure.
Other was called, one was called True. The other was called Argosy. And Argosy, I believe around 61 time, had an article, a front page article, well, the cover, with Donald Keyhole on it. And I was always very impressed with that man because here's a Marine, I think he was a colonel.
No-nonsense guy.
No-nonsense guy.
Yeah.
Steps to the microphone.
He was a major.
Yeah.
He was a major. Called it like it was. And said, these things are real. They're here now. We need to do something about it. And I kept thinking to myself, how does he stay in the military? Because they probably throw him out. But I think he was retired at that time. But it just impressed upon me how important this stuff was. So my brother and I began talking about these things and trying to figure out how they might work. And we came up with the idea, well, they must have some kind of electromagnetic engines in them that allow them to propel themselves off the Earth or off other bodies. And so we said, well, why don't we build one of these things? We'll build, you know, a 30-foot craft with three pulsed electromagnetic engines. We'll pulse them at this frequency. And I have no idea, Jeff, how we came up with this idea. It just was in our heads.
Wow.
And we designed this thing on paper. And
you're just a kid. This is amazing.
Yeah, well, my brother was pretty amazing. My brother, who's a year younger than me, was like a genius IQ. We were building telephone sets, rocket launchers, and all sorts of things as little kids, which I don't know any other kids doing that, but we were. And most of it was the brainchild of my brother, so uh-huh. He was really the brains behind it. But we together came up with this idea, and then one day my mother took us to the store, and we were shopping. I think it was Thrifty Drugstore. You remember you used to get the nickel ice cream cone at Thrifty Drugstore?
Yeah, they used to have wonderful ice when I was a little kid. They were still around. Yeah,
yeah, that was. I go to Baskin Robbins today, and I about fall over when they tell me I want $14 for three ice cream cones, you know, or whatever.
That's about it.
So,
yeah.
But anyway, we bought this magazine on the rack. It was a half-size magazine, a Flying Saucer Review, I think was the name of it. And it was a British publication. And we took it home. And we were sitting on the bed in his bedroom and reading this magazine. And in it, it said, you know, these UFOs are seen around military installations, nuclear power plants, and places where UFO research is, propulsion research is being done.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, well, we're doing UFO propulsion research. Maybe one of these things will come visit us. And they were just talking to each other, you know, as kids. And literally a month later, this craft shows up. So within the month, actually. So it was pretty strange, but
you're into it now. Give us a report, Jan. Where were you? What were you doing? What kind of a day was it? And how did you see it?
Well, it was a Saturday morning. I lived at one end of the house. We'd had four boys in the family, and we had bunk beds. And there was a three-bedroom house, and
uh-huh.
So my parents had I call it the oopsie baby, and a daughter came. And so they now had to put her in her own room and bump two of the boys out into the garage. So my father had made the garage into a bunk room, and
uh-huh.
I lived out in the garage. It was paneled and everything. It was a real room, but
sure.
I was out there. He was at the other end of the house, and 6:30 in the morning, I'm sleeping, and he comes into my room.
He who? Dad?
No, this is my brother.
Your brother, okay. So I just wanted to be sure. All right.
Yeah, it was my father. My father was asleep. My parents were asleep.
Okay.
Everybody in the house was asleep. He just came into my room, and he woke me up, and he said, there's somebody trying to break into my room. And I said, what do you mean? There's someone trying to break into your room. He says, well, there's somebody at the window trying to take out the screen and get into my room. And I thought, okay. I said, did you look out to see who it was? He said, no, I didn't look out to see who it was. I said, well, let's go back and see what's going on. So we walked to the other end of the house, looked into his bedroom, back towards the window, and there's nothing there. So I'm thinking, okay, well, whatever it was, it's gone. He says, no, there really was something there. I said, okay, well, then why don't we go out in the backyard and check? So we started walking down the hallway,
mm-hmm.
and I'm looking back at him talking, and I'm halfway thinking in my mind, oh, he's just pulling my leg on this thing. He's just trying to get me.
Now, this is early in the morning.
It's 6:30 in the
6:30,
morning.
6:30, all right. It's light then outside.
It was around the April time frame, right before the time change, and it was very bright outside.
Okay.
The sun had been up for at least half an hour.
Got it.
And all of a sudden, he says, look. And I spun around to see what he was looking at, and he was looking into our living room where we had a wall of glass, plate glass windows, which were covered with white sheer drapes. And I could see the sun coming in through the drapes. And I didn't see anything. I said, what do you want me to look at? And he says, there was somebody standing against the window. I could see their shadow. And when I told you to look, they floated backwards. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, now he's really pulling my leg on this thing. Right? But he used those words, float backwards. So I thought, that's strange.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I said, well, let's go out in the backyard and we'll go see what it is. So we went into the through the family room, which was on the other side of a kind of a brick wall with a fireplace, and through the kitchen into the garage. As we went through the kitchen, I noticed on the wall we have a big clock that it was exactly 6:30 in the morning.
Okay.
And so we went into the garage and out the back door to the end of the house to look back at his window, and there was nothing there. So I'm thinking, okay, he really is just making this up. He's just trying to get me on this thing, right? So I said, okay, well, there's nothing there. Jeff, let's go back in the house. So we turned around and go back in the house, and there, 30 feet from us, hanging 10 feet off the ground in our backyard, is a landing craft making a humming noise. And we just froze and stared at it.
It's hanging, suspended, motionless, humming, a landing craft. You're suggesting to me that it has some kind of legs on it? Describe it please.
Okay. The craft itself, I tell people it's like a brick. If you took a brick and you blew it up to the dimensions of 8 to 10 feet long by 4 feet wide by 3 feet high,
okay.
And completely smoothed the edges so it makes a tank, then painted it a bright orange, which was a strange color, but it was bright orange.
Wow.
And then the landing gear, there were four landing gear coming off of it. They came out of the sides and then dropped down. They would look like dryer hose, blue, cobalt blue dryer hose. You know how it's corrugated? It looks like an accordion. You know, it just comes down.
Jeez.
And then at the end of that was black suction cups. And then at between...
And how many?
Well, there were four landing gear.
Okay, so you had a brick-shaped thing, smooth like a tank, rounded edges. Bright orange.
Correct.
And these four landing gear with suction cups on the end are coming out. Are they, like, come out to a right angle and then down, or do they just come out like a flex hose down?
Probably more like a flex hose. They just kind of drooped down, you know, like
okay.
But they hung straight down.
Right.
And then there were brown on each side, because there were two landing gear on each side. There was a crossbar, the landing gear, like brown crossbar with a bolt in the middle, you know, where it would make a scissors action, like as it landed, it would cushion the landing. And so my first reaction was, oh my gosh, these things are real. It was just kind of like smacked me in the face. And then my second reaction, staring at it, was, oh my gosh, this thing looks like it's man-made. And the reason I came to that conclusion at that time was because I saw this bolt. But then I started looking at the surface of the craft, and I realized that the body of it was perfectly smooth. There was no rivets, no seams, no nothing. It was like glass. It was like a ceramic, you know, like it had been blown glass or something. And it was shiny and just smooth as could be. And so I'm thinking, oh my gosh, how the heck do they get in out of this thing? There's no windows, there's no doors.
Right.
You know, they must be very small people because it was only like 3 feet high.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, I'm staring at it.
And your brother's staring too. Are you guys talking?
No, we're just like our jaws are dropped.
You're thunderstruck, I'm sure. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Can you hold on right there, Jan? This is just really fascinating.
I'll hold.
We have to do a break, and we'll come right back. Just amazing. All right. Hang on. Don't go anywhere, folks. We shall continue. Okay, here we are, and George Feiler is here with us, the MUFON Eastern Director, Frank Chile, our friend and colleague of George's, and Jan Harazan, the president of the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. And this is really an amazing story. Okay, to recap, 6:30 in the morning, you and your brother standing in the backyard looking at a bright orange brick-like object, 10 feet by 4 feet by 3 feet tall, something like that, with rounded edges. Four, let's just call them hose-like landing gear with suction cup bottom or feet on each one of them. And it's humming. It's motionless. It's in the backyard. And how far away from you is it?
I'd say less than 30 feet. It was very close.
Okay. And a green grass lawn kind of a thing?
Yeah, in the backyard we had the mulberry bushes and different trees mm-hmm. growing around there.
All right.
But it was an unobstructed view. We were staring right at the craft.
And so your brother said, "Stay here," and he ran toward it and said, "Take me away."
Well, it was almost like that, but no, I actually said to him, "Stay here. I'm going to run in the house and get a camera." So we had a very technological camera back then. It was called the Brownie.
Ah, yes.
with the old 120 black and white film in it.
Uh-huh.
And so I ran into the garage, and I turned to go into the house, and we had locked ourselves out. So I began pounding on the door. Now, when we had gone out there, nobody was up in the house. Everyone was asleep.
Yeah, yeah.
There were five kids at the time and two parents. So the two of us were out. The other five people were still asleep in the house.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like I pounded for a good minute, minute and a half, as hard as I could. And I noticed during my knock, during one of my knocks, that it went, my hand went halfway down, stopped, and then went the rest of the way down, which I thought was strange. It was kind of like a discontinuity in my knock. But shortly after that, like a second or two later, my older brother answered the door, and he said, you know, what's going on? I said, nothing. I ran into the house, grabbed the camera. I didn't want to sit and explain it to him. I just ran out, got the camera, ran back out, and it seemed to me like it had only a minute or two had maybe 3 minutes had transpired between the time I said, I'm going to go get the camera, and I was back out there. But the craft was gone. My brother was standing on the swing set in our backyard. He climbed up the slide. There was stairs up to the top of the slide where he'd slide down. And he was looking out to the west, and I said, where'd it go? And he said, well, it just hovered there for a second, stayed perfectly still, and then it slowly started to drift to the west, and then out of sight, just went shot out of sight over the horizon. And it was gone. So I said, oh, gosh, darn it, we missed it. You know, I'm thinking... It was just an extraordinary time. I mean, I wish I'd gotten a picture of it, but it would have been a black and white.
That's an agonizing decision to make. You've heard it countless times. So has George. So has Frank. So have many of our listeners. What do you do when you see something so mind-boggling? Do you take a chance and go for the camera, or do you sit there, stand there, and continue to observe? That's a toughie.
Yeah, it is a tough one. I had no doubt I wanted to get it on camera, but it didn't work out, unfortunately.
Well, I really admire you for trying. That took a lot of internal strength to make that decision and to do it. Okay, so what was the fallout of this? What happened?
Well, the fallout was, you know, we talked about it, he, my brother, and I, and we decided that I was 10 at the time, he was 9, that no one would believe us. So we decided, well, we can't really report it to anyone because the police aren't going to.
Can't believe this. 9 or 10 years old. This sounds like one of the 1950s Hollywood sci-fi movies.
It was, you know, like Mayberry RFD. It was, you know, it was back in those days, you know, you kind of did what you did. But, we just decided it better if we just kept it to ourselves. So we didn't really tell anyone about it. Now, I went to school Monday morning, and I told my best friend about it. We were out on the playground, and I said, uh-huh. Hey, Tom, you won't believe what happened this weekend. I went through the whole story of what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
And he just looked me in the eye, and he said, do you want to go play baseball? And it struck me, like, did you just hear what I mean, the thing to myself, did you just hear what I said? I mean, this is like an incredible thing that just happened. And you want to go play baseball? I'm thinking to myself. And it really dawned on me that people, if it's not within their worldview, they cannot accept it.
No, doesn't fit.
No.
Yeah,
exactly. So I made a decision right there. Well, I guess I can't really share this with anybody because they're just going to either think I'm crazy or that I made a mistake or, you know, something happened.
What extraordinary life lessons you're learning at the age of 10, 11.
Exactly.
It's just amazing about human nature and our species. Go ahead, please.
I think it's one of the biggest things that keeps from making advances in this field is the fact that, you know, scientists and different people, I mean, there are scientists who do believe it's real and they are studying it, but you know, they keep it very quiet to themselves because, Lord forbid, that they
share this
with anyone.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I can't tell you the number of scientists I've asked to come to a MUFON symposium and speak, and it's like, well, you know, I have a great talk, but I really don't feel like it would be in my best interest to do that, right? So,
oh, yeah.
Or they come up with a good excuse like, oh, I'm going to England that time of the year. I can't make it. Something. So, but I think that's one of the challenges we have. We've talked about it early on in the show, which is that we need to make it safe for scientists and people, researchers, to be able to pursue this as part of their jobs, as part of their university contracts, whatever they're doing, without fear of reprisal, without fear of being, you know, losing the opportunity to get the Nobel Prize for sake of a better word.
Well, you're not exaggerating either. Now, here we are with a phenomenon that is arguably, well, not to me, it is, the most important of our lifetime, period. And it's not featured on the nightly news, the mainstream media. If you remember the O'Hare Airport event, the broad daylight event where the disc hovered above one of the gates, that was 6 months before it came out. Same kind of thing with the Phoenix Lights. It was even longer than that. But we have no columns in any newspapers, not even a weekly UFO report of the week or the month or the whatever. There's nothing in the news press.
Nope.
The papers, the press, the electronic media, nowhere. Now, obviously, someone has been telling people that we don't cover that. We just don't do it. There has to have been a word given to somebody at some in every major news media outlet. We don't do that. Has
right.
To be.
Well, you know what's interesting? I got a call about 5 years ago from a TV station up in Los Angeles, and we run monthly meetings down in Orange County here. Where I was, at the time, I was the state section director for MUFON Orange County, California.
Yeah.
And they wanted to come down. They'd heard about our meetings, and they wanted to come down and film it. And so what I always do with the media is I always ask the question, like, what do you know about UFOs? And it just flabbergasts me that invariably, 100% of the time, it's like, I don't know anything. Well, you know, how are you going to cover a story you know nothing about? So I immediately begin educating them, right? Well, first off, I want to find out what their angle is on the story, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Are you going to go make a silly factor story? Are you going to do this? But I started educating them. Well, they came down, and they were very polite, film crew and the reporter. And I introduced them to Dr. Bob Wood, you know, PhD, you know, 43 years with McDonnell Douglas. He used to do UFO research for Mr. McDonnell himself.
Yeah, he knew my father. My father was public relations director at McDonnell Douglas, Missiles and Space back then.
Yes. Well, there you have it. Yeah, exactly. And we had another Dr. Robert Spordone, who was a member at the board at that time, was on our board. Was a neuroscientist out of UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
We had some very, very heavyweight type people who, mm-hmm. and actually he had done some work for some of the intelligence communities, who were very evident. And so I set them up with interviews with these people just to talk to them so they would get the sense that this is
of
not
course.
Silliness, right?
Journalism 101, I got it. Yeah,
so they took the story, they filmed the meeting, they filmed the different people, they did the interviews, they took me out and shot a little space shot with me standing on a rock looking at the moon, you know, I mean, because they had to have a little something dramatic, right? And then they told me, well, this will be on tomorrow night's news, right? And so I watched the next night, and nothing on the news. And I wrote the guy, and I said, you know, did I miss something? Did it not go on? He said, oh, they're gonna reschedule it for another time. Well, this thing kept going on and on and on. Finally, he said, well, my editor killed the story. And the only thing I can think of, Jeff, is that we made it so credible that they didn't know what to do with it.
You got it. You nailed it. Sure. What station was this? Can you tell us?
I believe it was NBC.
Yeah, KNBC in LA. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, makes sense. I was a television news director and anchorman for 12 years, and I know exactly what happened with that story. And
right.
I knew where you were going when you started it. It never saw the light of a video tube.
It's very unfortunate. In fact, our symposium this year in Philadelphia, it's actually 15 minutes outside in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. But the theme is UFOs in the media, and we're going to be talking about this. You know, what is it that keeps the major media from covering this? You know, and then how do we get the word out? Because there are people like James Fox and others who are trying to do their job to get this stuff on the major media, but it's still not on our major news channels, not in any way. I mean, they pick up on some of these crazy YouTube viral videos, which more than not end up being something
It's not helpful.
No.
And this needs to be studied logically, pragmatically, with determination and professional standards. And until and unless the five corporations that control 95% or more of the mainstream media in this country give the green light, there's not going to be much progress, if any. The delay on the Chicago O'Hare story, which Peter Davenport broke and was picked up by that guy one of the Chicago papers, finally, and he had to go with it because the pressure got to be so much that the paper had to do something. And then look at the Phoenix Lights. Enormous
right.
event. And nothing. Nothing until, I guess, it was June or July, wasn't it? When right before Roswell was going to go
right.
off, that the story came out.
Exactly. Exactly. This just stuff doesn't make it. It's amazing to me. Because it is so, like you said, it's the story of the century, and yet nobody wants to cover it. I think it's so far out of the belief system, or so far out, or there's just a very overt.
Now the lid has been clamped down, screwed down, and welded. It's both. It's all of the above. You've named it. However, I do believe that ultimately those in power, if this story were to come out, feared that they would lose control. Of people. People would say, well, hell with you. What do we need this crap for? All your wars and everything? There's intelligent life out there. So they'd
right.
have a big problem. And that's why I think everything dried up in the 70s. In the 60s, amazing reports in the newspapers, as you said. And to this very day, I've told Peter, I've mentioned George, he's got George's Filer's Files is wonderful. But there ought to be a nationally syndicated column of reports of the week. However, but there's nothing. And that tells me that the lid is down.
Down hard, yes. With the exception of maybe of Lee Spiegel, I don't know, maybe Billy Cox. I mean, there's very
well,
few people
Billy,
writing about it.
Yeah. Billy's, I look at them as tokens.
Exactly.
They're allowed to do what they do, so people won't think, well, wait a minute, how could Billy Cox write if there was a lid buttoned down on this thing? So, they leave it go. And, yeah, just little noise on the sidelines. Like kids throwing pebbles in Lake Michigan. It just doesn't matter.
Exactly. Hey, would you like me to share a couple of sighting reports with you?
Please, Jan. Okay. We're talking with Jan Harzan. George Filer's here. Frank Chile's here. He is the new executive director of the Mutual UFO Network. Go at it, Jan, please.
Oh, sure. Well, we're just chasing a couple of different major stories right now. I can only give you kind of the high-level view of it, but because we've got different people from an investigation standpoint diving into it. But we have on our website, MUFON.com, if you go there on the right-hand side, there's a scrolling piece which has all the latest sighting reports as they come in. They get vetted and then written about by Roger Marsh, our editor for the journal. But the one that's scrolling there right now is a Coast Guard sailor who in 1978 or 9 was on a Coast Guard cutter off the coast of Cuba. And he and another one of his buddies on the Coast Guard ship saw a transparent oval-shaped craft that came within 200 yards of his vessel that had in it, it was translucent, so transparent, so he could actually see the humanoid pilot flying it before it quickly disappeared.
Wow.
So he's given us that testimony. It's the MUFON case 57018.
Mm-hmm.
He's being interviewed now, and we're pursuing getting more information on this.
What year was this again, please?
It was either late 1978 or early 1979 is what he recalls.
Uh-huh.
He was on a law enforcement Coast Guard cutter just off the coast or near Cuba,
mm-hmm.
and they were standing near the fantail
mm-hmm.
with another sailor, and when they first saw the object fly by. Yeah,
mind-boggling, just mind-boggling for any number of reasons, and fascinating, too. If I were to see something like that, I would laugh. I would just start laughing. I think that would be my first reaction.
I think it'd be kind of cool to see a translucent craft with a pilot.
It'd be totally cool. I mean, I would just say that. Come on, cover up, absurd. I don't care about their cover ups. Let them cover it up. We know what's going on. Those who need to know. Thanks to people like you and George and Frank and others. Tell us more.
Yeah, and so we have another one here, which we're also pursuing. A sailor who was aboard the aircraft carrier, the USS Nimitz. Back in August time frame of 1991, he was a photographer, and he had a habit of going out on the watch deck to watch the sunset in the aft of the ship. And so he every night would go out there and watch the sun go down. And on this one night, he was out of his lab late, which is, I assume, his photography lab he's talking about, and went aft to watch the stars. Anyway, as he was standing there, the ship went dark, and I'm learning a little bit about the Navy here. They do run exercises where they turn out all the lights on the ship and they lock it all down. They put all the sailors inside, and they basically sit dead in the water so they're not seen or heard if
sure.
there's other ships in any area.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, he didn't know that they were doing that until it was already done, and so he was stuck out on the ship. He was basically locked out of the ship.
Oh, funny.
So as he's standing out there,
mm-hmm.
he sees this large triangle come up out of the ocean. This thing is hundreds of yards big, and tilts. It sits there for 15 minutes, just perfectly still, just hovering. And then it tilts up at a 45-degree angle, and then just shoots off into space like in a blink of an eye. And he has been traumatized by this for the last, 91, probably the last 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
He had shared with me when he actually phoned this into us that he hadn't even told his wife about it or his daughter because he didn't want them to think he was crazy.
This happens. But boy, does he deserve credit for coming forward, even now. That's remarkable.
Yeah, and he said he had the, here's the strange thing about it, because you know the other things coming out on this whole and with some of these break-ins to NASA's and other people's computers. He said, I really think, Jan, that it was ours. And he said, the reason I'm thinking that is I think that's why they made everybody go inside the ship and locked it down, was so that they wouldn't see this thing take off. He doesn't know. I mean, he just
Now, that's an interesting, that's 25 years ago. At the rate technology is expanding and exploding, God only knows where they are now, if that was ours.
Right, and he doesn't know. He's just saying.
Yeah, no, it's a good guess. Yeah. It's a good postulation.
Yeah, okay. He's asking himself, why was it that I was allowed to see this? You know, yeah. I mean, he could have been court-martialed. He could have been yelled at. He did say that later on that he was talked to by his superiors because they had heard a rumor that he had been locked out, which he denied, vehemently denied.
What a smart man.
Very smart. He vehemently denied being locked out. But, you know, nothing ever came of it. But what came of it was he's been traumatized, and he's literally suffering from what I would consider to be post-traumatic stress syndrome from this whole event.
I think so, sure.
Yeah, and very fearful of sharing it, honestly. I mean, he's afraid for his life, you know, in terms of talking about it, but we're getting him to come forward and at least tell the story. Mm-hmm. We'll obviously, you know, protect his name and his witness information, but we'd like to see this out to the general public.
It has. Like I say, we have a God-given right to this information. I really believe that.
Cannot agree with you more.
This object, hundreds of yards big, how thick was it? Do we have a range on that yet?
You know, he didn't actually tell us, but from his description, it was a very thick craft.
It's huge. This is a gigantic piece of machinery.
Yes, exactly. And it was just hovering there, just perfectly motionless again in the sky.
Yeah.
He said up to 15 minutes, and then all of a sudden it tilted up, and bam, it was gone. Shot off into space.
I just rather doubt that that was ours. Now, maybe the Navy knew something, some activity was coming somehow with their sonar and their radar, and maybe from Washington. Who knows? We do track these things. But,
absolutely.
That technology is wow.
One of our well-known MUFON members, Mark D'Antonio, who does some of our photo analysts, he got a ride on a submarine, and I hate to tell the story on the air because it's his story, but he actually was there and had seen something going 200, 300 miles an hour underneath the ocean, and there have been other reports of this by Navy ships that they've clocked something traveling under the ocean at, you know, hundreds of miles per hour. Now, our understanding of the friction that the ocean creates, there's no way anything man-made could go that fast underwater, at least anything that we know in the normal world. But obviously there's craft operating under our oceans, and they're coming up out of the ocean and then shooting off into space. So something's happening.
Well, why not? They go through space, which is essentially a vacuum, or it's called a vacuum.
Right.
They go through our atmosphere. Water's just a little bit thicker. What do they care? Now, we do know that this cavitation technology, which creates an air bubble around a torpedo, allows the torpedo to go much faster than it normally could just up against the water. I've forgotten the exact terminology, but I think you've heard of it. There's an actual air mass created around the moving object, which allows it to say, essentially, it's traveling through air.
Right. And there's probably, these craft probably use that same principle or something similar to it.
I would think.
Yep.
Wow. Jan, we're out of time. I got to get back to George and Frank for our last couple minutes. Don't go away. I would like to extend an invitation to you to, if you want, appear on this program anytime you'd like to bring cases forward. George can come on with you, of course. Frank, whatever. But I want to make this available to you and the Mutual UFO Network to bring this material forward. You can have an hour a month, every other month, whatever you want to do. It's just an offer, and I want to make it because I've been supportive of this whole idea that we've got to get the lie ended. We have a right to this information. So the offer's on the table, however I can help.
I appreciate that, Jeff. And I just invite all your listeners, if they're on the East Coast, that we have our symposium coming up July 18th through the 20th in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. We'd love to see you all there.
Great. Frank, Chile, you've been very quiet back there. This
I'm a
phenomenon.
Student. I'm still a student. I'm still a student, Jeff.
There you go.
I enjoyed the stories immensely, Jan. I would like to ask you one question. Did you share the experience you and your brother had with your parents, and how did they react?
You know, we did, but not till several years later. And their reaction was quite, oh, yeah, they believe it. You know, they had no problem believing it, which we found fascinating. We assumed they wouldn't you know, believe it from coming from some kids. But we did a couple years later, and they were like, oh, yeah, no big deal, of course.
What kind of work did your father do?
He was in sales. He's deceased now, but he was in sales at the time and did, traveled as a salesman all over the world.
Obviously had some extraordinary parents. Very good people indeed. Well, look at the job they did with you. I imagine your brothers and sisters are just as good. What did your brother go on to do?
Well, he basically does his own business in terms of helping repair and build things. The whole experience was rather traumatic, and unfortunately for him, it drove him into drugs and alcohol. But he's since recovered. He's sober and living a good life, and
good.
Just helping people out, and everything's going well for him now.
Good for him. Well, I'm glad to hear that. George Filer, thank you, my friend of many years.
You're welcome.
For making this possible. Just great. You must be as excited as you could be to have Jan at the helm. We've got somebody who is just extraordinarily gifted, can take this information and the organization to levels it has never been at before. So
Thank you.
You're welcome, Jan. Anything you want to add, George?
Well, I'm always happy to send my files to everybody. And it's growing, and every time we send it out, we ask people to join MUFON to get the real details. I try to hit the highlights, and we go from there. It's kind of like Reader's Digest weekly of what's going on in the world of UFOs. And there, every week, there's many sightings, and we're getting roughly 50 a week or 50 a day.
And, 50 a day. Well, folks, if you would like to get a free subscription to George's Filer's Files, just ask him. Write to Major, M-A-J-O-R, Star, S-T-A-R, at Verizon.net. Tell him you heard him here and you'd like to get on his list, and he'll send those to you weekly to your electronic mailbox. Major, Star, at Verizon.net. Thanks, George, very much.
You're welcome.
Okay, and Frank, do you take care?
Jeff, thanks for the opportunity again to share.
Always. And Jan, thank you, and we'll talk again.
Thank you, Jeff.
Okay. All right. That's quite an hour for you folks, and we'll take a break and come right back. Hour number 3 coming up.